Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is UNLV professor and author David G. Schwartz. We'll be talking about his book, Roll the Bones, which is a history of casino gambling. We'll be talking to Professor Schwartz in a few minutes. In the news, the Peppermill Casino in Reno was fined $1 million for copying data from competitor slot machines and looking at accounting or other data using a widely available 2341 key that all floor people carry around with them all the time. They got caught in something like the fifth or eighth casino they use this key. I'm astounded it took so long to catch them. I figured surveillance or other casino employees would catch on to them before too long. I can understand why a casino would want to know certain competitor data, but going directly and collecting it without permissions is very much over the line. Kind of like I may well want to know whether a particular girl looks like unclothed, but that doesn't give me the right to be a peeping Tom. I could be arrested and jailed for this, although my fine would certainly be less than $1 million. Richard, what do you make of this?
It's just mind-bogglingly stupid. I just can't imagine the meeting where some guy said, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we send a guy out to do this? It's just mind-boggling to me. Maybe the casinos think they're so powerful they don't have to worry about the laws. I don't know. I'm speechless.
Professor Schwartz, you used to work in surveillance. Do you have any insights into how this could go on undetected for so long?
Well, you know, I will say this. I took a course with the Gaming Control Board here in detecting cheating, and it's incredible how quick and easy it is to actually get inside of a slot machine if you've got the right key. So there were some slot cheating scams where people would have a bootleg key and not only would be turning the key to access the data, like apparently was going on in this case, but actually physically opening up the machines and getting in there. And it's kind of amazing how quickly you can do that and then set the wheels and then shut the door and get a bogus payout if you're cheating and the machine's vulnerable to that. So it's, you know, you got to remember the casinos are pretty big places. If somebody's acting surreptitiously and trying to make it look like they're doing something else and they're good at it, it might be hard to catch them.
Does that kind of cheating with slots still go on to this day? I thought that was sort of a thing of the past. My understanding is that any time the door of a machine opens now, basically an alert goes off in surveillance. And normally if a machine is going to be opened, they call surveillance ahead of time to say, we're going to be opening this machine.
Well, I'm not aware of it going being that sophisticated, because then any time they did slot drops or now doing removing the validators, you'd have a lot of alarms go off. You know, at minimum what happens is the candle on top lights up, which you would be able to see. You know, theoretically, if you're a security person walking around, you see that the candle's gone off, and you would want to look at that and see, well, is there an employee there or not? But, you know, back when they were able to do it, and now also because of the play history you have in the machines, it's really not going to do you any good if you reset the reels to a bogus payout. They'll just review the play history and see that that's not the payout it's supposed to be, and you won't get anything. But, you know, back when they were doing this, they were able to get in there pretty quickly and do it. You know, although today I wouldn't think that this would work again, because they've got a lot of very sophisticated countermeasures that they've developed. But, you know, in general, I think if you're doing, and not knowing what happened with this, you know, I think if you're in a casino and you look like you know what you're doing and you're not drawing attention to yourself, that might get you pretty far.
Very good. Let's go on. On last week's show, Richard was asking me about how to figure out a slot club at a certain unnamed casino in Southern California, which after the show he said was Pechanga, which is in Temecula, California, which is in the general San Diego area, furthest north and furthest west of those casinos in the San Diego area. Richard went online at VP Free and asked questions about Pechanga there. Did you get your questions satisfactorily answered, Richard?
Yeah, actually I did. Not so much people posting on VP Free, but I received some emails from people who saw the posts, because sometimes this information is not something you want to post on an open forum. So it turned out to be really valuable, actually. As it turns out, it doesn't look like it's worth me playing there, but that's valuable information to know. I found it very helpful. The people who emailed me, were very helpful indeed. I haven't found a place. I just wish I lived closer to a casino so I could try to explore more in depth some of these things with video poker.
Yeah, I read the answers, and you didn't get precise answers to your question, partly because casinos don't publish exact requirements. It's rare to have a slot system that tells you if you play a specific amount, say $15,000 coin in, that you'll get a free show ticket. The systems are usually far more nuanced than that, and it depends on the theoretical of the particular machine. It depends on whether you won or lost. Sometimes it matters whether you're local or an out-of-towner. Sometimes it depends on whether or not your host likes you and how much clout that host has.
That was one of the things I found shocking, actually. Somebody mentioned that it can also matter if you speak with an accent, which I didn't realize that hosts actually had that much power to, at least in regard to what you're getting in the mail.
Right. Now, in terms of the show tickets, you were not concerned with the mail, and usually hosts would have minimal input on the mail. But of the people who did respond online, several of the most knowledgeable people on VP Free chipped in. And they didn't give you a roadmap to exactly what you're looking for, but they gave you insight into how they would attack this problem, and such insight is very valuable.
Yes. Yeah. I definitely, if I decide to target another place for video poker, I definitely will use it again.
All right. The third Nevada online casino is beta testing right now. It's called Real Gaming, and it's associated with South Point Casino. You can play from anywhere in Nevada on PC, Mac, tablets, or smartphones. The software was created from scratch using the latest technologies, which I see as good news and bad news. Richard, what's your take on this?
Well, when they first started, they actually came out very early with a free version, and we Yes. talked about it at the time. When you're starting from scratch, I mean, basically they were reinventing the wheel, and their free versions, had a lot of bugs and a lot of annoying flashing soft advertising and stuff like that. So I don't know. We'll have to see. I mean, right now, World Series of Poker seems to have more of the business than the Ultimate Poker in Nevada. Ultimate Poker, I think the rake is slightly less, so we'll have to see once they are up and running if their rakes are competitive and if they get the traffic. That's the main thing. Will the people go there to play? Because poker players want choices. They want choices in games and stakes, and you need players.
And Economics 101 says the more sellers there are in the market, then the price is going to go down. And so the rakes overall will go down with more sites out there. All right, let's talk to our guest, Professor David G. Schwartz, Director of the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. In addition, he's a writer, speaker, and consultant. His PhD is in history, and most of his writings are related to the history of gambling. We spoke to Professor Schwartz a few months ago on this show about his book, Grandissimo, The First Emperor of Las Vegas, How Jay Sarno Won a Casino Empire, Lost It, and Inspired Modern Las Vegas. Tonight, we're going to be talking to him about his book, Roll the Bones, The History of Gambling. Professor Schwartz, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Well, you're welcome. Glad you're here. In a few minutes, tell us how gambling today in America is different from gambling in the 19th century in Europe.
Well, the first way it's different is that it's much more widespread. For a big chunk of the 19th century, pretty much the only place you could gamble in Europe was Monte Carlo. So today, there is a lot more availability for all different kinds of gambling. You didn't have a lot of lotteries in Europe at that time either. Most countries had outlawed them. And you definitely didn't have slot machines, which is the other big thing, which leads to the second thing, which is the kinds of games are different. In the golden years of Monte Carlo, so it's pretty much the last quarter of the 19th century, roulette was by far the top game. It had about the position that Baccarat has in Macau today. Everybody wanted to play this game. They had a couple other games, but it was mostly roulette. And roulette was a fascinating game for that time, where there was the Second Industrial Revolution was going on. There's advances in science and mathematics. And it's the kind of game that's conducive to gambling systems. So trying to figure out how to bet in a way that's going to help you win. And it's not skill play the way that you guys would do it, where you're trying to exploit the game itself. And probably exploit's the wrong word, but you're trying to get an edge in the game itself. It's really trying to figure out how to bet. And a lot of it was related to mathematical principles that have since been debunked. So there was a lot of different systems that people developed, you know, doubling up every time you win, doubling up every time you lose, doubling up every third time you lose. There was all kinds of systems that people tried out. And the thing about the systems that they were just figuring out then, but I think a lot of people know now, is that in the short term, you can be successful. As I'm sure all of your listeners know, it's in gambling, the law of large numbers is a very important thing. Over time, you're going to tend to gravitate towards that house edge. There's going to be that regression of the mean. But in the short run, there's a lot of volatility. So these people develop systems. They won a couple times, and then they made a lot more money selling the system than they did playing after that. So I think that's the big difference, is the kind of game that they played, which was mostly roulette, and the fact that it was so really confined to this one place. Those are the big differences.
But the very first casinos were a couple of hundred years before that, right, in Italy?
Yes. Yeah,
and
1638.
One of the things I found fascinating in the book, actually, was that you had to wear masks. You had to wear a mask to enter the casino.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. Originally, the casinos were only open during Carnival, during that season, so I guess the masks made some sense there, but it was really the idea that gambling was something that was shameful, and everybody agreed that it was fun, but you wouldn't want anybody to see you doing it, so you had to wear a mask to go into a casino. Now, today, of course, we know that if you go into a casino, you're almost certainly, with a mask, you're almost certainly going to be asked to remove it or removed from the premises because of crime risks and that sort of thing, so you can't wear a mask. It's kind of funny how that's flipped in our culture, where, you know, once was that you had to hide yourself from gambling, and now you're not allowed to hide yourself from gambling.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners would like to be able to wear a mask in the casino.
Yeah, and I know a lot of the skill players traditionally have come pretty close. So that's, yeah, I mean, so the, yeah, that is kind of funny how that's changed.
Now, in addition to players want to disguise what they're doing, gambling in the United States has been intimately connected with criminal activity since it started. Players could not expect to get a fair shake, whether a lot of professional gamblers were cheats, plain and simple. Often the casinos themselves participated in the cheating. In Las Vegas itself, organized crime has played a major role in our history. today, casinos largely deal fair games, peppermint scandal notwithstanding. How did you see this transformation take place?
A lot of it happens because of legalizing casinos. So let's imagine that you're running an illegal gambling den back in 1870 in New York City.
Okay.
If you run, the big game is Faro, which has a pretty small house edge. You guys maybe know it. I think it's something like 0.5% is the house edge in Faro. So it's a pretty razor-thin game. If you're going to be banking a game, Faro is not a one that's going to, it's not a one that's going to give you a really big margin. So it's already pretty narrow. Build into that the fact that you've got to keep your bankroll because you have a lot of players coming in and they could have a lot of money. So you've got to have a nice bankroll to back you up. Then build into the fact that even though you're not paying any taxes, what you're doing is illegal, so you have to pay off a lot of politicians, police, and judges and that sort of thing to stay in business. So what happens was if you were running an honest operation, you pretty much wouldn't have the money to pay the graft. And when somebody said, hey, we need some reform, we need to shut down gambling, the people who were paying off the police would say, well, we should go down the block and raid that guy. So the police look like they're doing their job, the judges can hand out harsh sentences, and the people who are paying off the everybody get to go on. So in that kind of environment, there's absolutely no competitive advantage to running an honest place. There's none, because you're not going to be able to make enough money to stay in business. When they get out to Nevada, and at first there was minimal taxes, really minimal taxes. I think it was maybe 1% was the first gaming tax, I believe in 1945, but I could be off by a couple of years. The first state tax. Before that, it was licensed at the county level. And again, it was pretty, today's standards, it was very minimal. You no longer had that. You know, you did, however, because you're doing this legally, if you get caught cheating people, you can lose your right to do this. And there's a lot, there is a dispute resolution mechanism in the law. If you got caught cheating somebody in one of these clip joints back east that were illegal, the players really didn't have a lot of recourse because they were doing something illegal. It was sort of like somebody getting defrauded in a drug deal where they think they're buying cocaine and they buy sugar or something like that. You know, you can't really go to the police and say this was supposed to be cocaine, not sugar. You know, it was the same thing with that. So they wouldn't really have any way to complain. So that all changed in Nevada. And this is kind of interesting because it affects the way that Americans gamble. If you look at a lot of the clip joints, they had very basic amenities. They might have a little bit of food, a little bit of drink, just enough to give you something.
Sawdust
but
joints.
Generally speaking, even the nice places wanted to get you in and wanted to get you out. They didn't want you lingering around because the games are crooked. They know you're going to lose. And there's no reason for you to hang around because then you're going to see that everybody's losing. And also another funny thing is they did have a lot of marketing back then, and they put money into that. So they'd have shills who you walk in the door, you know, basically you would have somebody called a capper who spots you at the train station and says, hey, I hear there's this great gambling hall. Let's go down there. You walk in the door, and the second you walk in the door, you see somebody win a tremendous amount of money and take the house, almost break the bank. And you say, oh, my God, this place is giving money away. Now, it turns out that person is a shill. They're really working for the house. So if you have an atmosphere where people are hanging out there habitually, they're going to notice that the same people keep winning. So basically, get them in the door, get them out. With an honest casino where you're giving people a fair shot to win the games, even though those games have a house edge, you need time for that. And the reason why casinos developed to have so many rooms and restaurants and shows and all that is because of the house edge. Picture this: if you're a casino boss in 1950 in Nevada, and you want to keep your players there because in the short run they could get very lucky, playing craps, playing blackjack, they could get very lucky and take you for a lot of money. You don't want them leaving your property with your bankroll. You want to keep them at the tables as long as you can. And the only way to do that is to give them all these other attractions. So that's why gambling in America, after it was legalized, developed in the way it did.
Well, but it did take quite a number of years. I mean, it was still pretty common for cheating to go on in Las Vegas, you know, into the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, there was, but it wasn't the fundamental basis of the business model. So yeah, I mean, it did go on, and certainly there was skimming and that sort of thing. Not quite so much direct cheating of the customers, but there was a lot of skimming and stuff like that going on, which is, I guess, cheating the government, but not necessarily the customers. Although I guess the customers live in the state, they're getting cheated. So that happened. And, you know, there's also some of the gamblers had a code of honor and would think it was a blot on their honor if they got caught cheating somebody. Not all of them, but some of them. It all depends. It takes all types. You know, some of them just want to make money. Some of them are proud of the fact that they're offering a fair gamble, and if the player beats them fair and square, they will pay him that money if it's their last cent. So a lot of different characters.
When the first...
Go ahead, Bob.
When the first edition of your book came out in 2006, the Wynn Casino had just opened in Las Vegas. It was the latest and greatest and most expensive ever. Las Vegas was the world's undisputed king of gambling. When the second edition came out 7 years later, there had been a recession. Las Vegas has been surpassed by Macau by a large margin and will soon be surpassed again by Singapore in terms of gambling revenue. How do you see this transforming Las Vegas in the future, if at all?
I think in a really big way, and I don't think it's really sunk in yet. Like you said, when I wrote the first edition, really Las Vegas was the place. Macau was just kind of opening up to the American companies, and people weren't really sure what was going to happen. Was it legit? Was it not legit? You know, 7 years later, it was so clear. You know, obviously Macau is huge, $45 billion in gaming revenue last year with about 35 casinos. About 330 casinos in Nevada in 2013 produced about $11 billion. So the entire state of Nevada is making less than one quarter of what these 35 casinos in Macau are doing. So that has been the huge shift. The recession also changed a lot about Las Vegas and the way the city runs. I think the average gambler has less money now. So on the gambling side, there's been a much greater shift to the Asian high rollers. So it's fascinating that within less than 10 years, a lot of the basis of Las Vegas has changed. You know, if you look at a place like Wynn, they could get 50% of the business from Asia. You know, not the company's business, because the company's business is about 70-75% from Macau and only about 20-25% from Vegas. But in Las Vegas, they're probably getting about half of their business from Asia. So that's just a huge change.
I was interested. One of the things I found interesting in the book was this guy Blanc, and his approach. I mean, can you talk about him? I mean, basically he took over the business, right? I mean, he basically owned the gambling business, and the way he did it was by lowering the house edge.
Yeah, it's really, really fascinating. So him and his brother started off, it's somewhat shady people. They were involved in this stock swindling scheme, but managed to get out of that and decided to reinvent themselves and bought one of the gambling concessions in a place called Bad Homburg, which was one of the many spa towns of gambling, and made a pretty good show of it and became really the top gaming operators of the day, because what they did is originally roulette had two zeros and they removed one of them and basically cut the house edge in half. And, you know, today you'd call that, I guess, running a successful retail business, because even though they, of course, made less money directly from the customers, you had more of them coming. So, and this is really a tension that you still see in the casinos today, you know. Some executives think that you want to give players the best deal they possibly can get, and you can win on that, and they'll advertise loosest slots. Others believe that that the players would be satisfied to play a machine with a 12% hold, and if you give it to them with 6% hold, you're just basically giving money away, and you're not going to see that money again. So it's a real, it's two different ways of looking at the business, I think. And Francois Blanc really looked at it as, I want to give people a good gamble, and in the end, the house edge is going to take care of me. And he had one of the greatest sayings of all time that any casino operator could have. Of course, blanc means white in French, and he said, sometimes red wins, sometimes black wins, but in the end, white always wins. So he knew how the gambling business should work. You know, and I think that's what most players would ask of an honest operator is, give me a fair chance. You know, I'm not saying to give me a game with a positive expectation, but at least give me a chance, and we'll see what happens. You know, I don't know. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, it just seems that whenever somebody does this, they end up making a lot of money. But for some reason, you know, the casinos just can't seem to learn this lesson. I mean, when Bill Zender had the Aladdin, you know, he loosened all the games and they had the best hold of any casino on the Strip. I don't get why they can't get that through their head. And this was 200 years ago, right, that he was running his casinos?
Yeah, it was about the last quarter of the 19th century. So, yeah, it's really interesting that you can see historically a lot of things that people might say try and say, well, this is totally new, people have been doing for a long time, and it's either been forgotten or just somebody's gone on and done something else. But, yeah. So when he started, there was a bunch of different places where you could gamble in Europe, a bunch of different spa towns in Germany and France, and they gradually all dried up. So originally he was competing in price. He was farsighted enough to take a look at Monte Carlo, which at the time that he looked at it was absolutely nothing, but said, well, hey, this is in this independent principality of Monaco. At the time he was French. The places where the casinos are were in what is now Germany, and relations between the French and the Germans were not so great in the last half of the 19th century, especially after the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, when France got really beaten quite badly. And he could see that, well, if the Prussians get their act together and decide to outlaw gambling, which is mostly run by the French, were in trouble. So he kind of gave himself a safety valve, gave himself an out in Monaco, and was able to build that business up before German gambling closed down completely, which was about 1873, give or take, a little after the end of the Franco-Prussian War. So he was really able to kind of see the future there, which is interesting. If you look at the operators today, you look at people like Steve Wynn, Sheldon Adelson, MGM, going into Macau, and you can see how the similarities, where they're very successful in one market, and they just see a little glimmer of what the future could bring, and they go to another market, and it ends up being for the best.
Well, it's also very much what the internet casino operators did in realizing that the laws may change to hurt them, so move everything offshore to the islands in Costa Rica where, sure, you know, they have a haven.
Yeah, which is another interesting part about gambling history. So, you know, part of the book is about the legal casinos and the growth of that industry. The other part is about the thriving illegal gambling that's been going on for quite a while. And for most of history, most forms of gambling were illegal. Today in the U.S., really the last remaining big holdout is sports betting, which is fascinating, you know, why that one remains and none of the others do. Mostly the reason is because in the 60s, states were looking to legalize gambling. And it's interesting because in the 50s, when they were studying illegal gambling, they pretty much all said, well, the numbers, which is the lottery-type game, this is the worst game, it's the most progressive game, it's got terrible for the player, the operator keeps more than half, oh my God, it's awful. In sports betting, at least, they kind of get a fair shake. And, yeah, maybe you could see if you legalize that wouldn't be so terrible because people could win. And it's kind of funny that once they actually got into the 60s and they talked about doing it, you know, which game did every state choose to legalize? The lottery, which is less fair to the player. So
the biggest,
kind of
the biggest
why they
house
do
edge, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Huge. So it kind of shows you when they finally got around to talking about, well, what do we need? We need money for the state. What are we going to do? It wasn't, well, we'll legalize sports betting, which is popular with people and which has a low house edge. And in fact, if things go badly, house can lose. it was, well, the lottery's pretty much guaranteed, and we don't really care if it might be regressive, but it's a guaranteed source of revenue. It's kind of interesting, and you could see in the 60s and 70s this debate going on, and lotteries won out, so that's why sports betting is still not legal in most states today.
It's not about your book per se, but Bally's Casino here in Las Vegas is shutting down its long-running topless review, Jubilee, for retooling. This show is a classic in Las Vegas history. Since you're a historian, can you give us some perspective as to what topless shows meant to Las Vegas?
I think they were very big. You know, if you go back to the late 50s, when they brought them over from France, it was considered so scandalous for a woman to dance topless that they couldn't find American dancers. They had to hire dancers from France because they supposedly couldn't find American women who would do this, would dance in public without their tops on. You know, since then, in the 50, 60 years since then, I think the culture has changed a lot. You know, if you want to see naked women, or for that matter, naked men, it's really not that difficult to do that if you've got an internet connection, at the very least.
Or even live in anywhere in the country.
Yeah. I mean, there's that too. You know, you've got actual strip clubs where they're bumping and grinding and lap dances and all that kind of stuff. So it's a much different culture now. But when they brought this out to Las Vegas, this was really unprecedented in the U.S., the fact that you'd have these bare-breasted women in the theater dancing around. And I think it really kind of was something new, something original. It also helped Las Vegas to brand itself, where you could go to you could see showgirls in other cities, but it wasn't quite like what Vegas had, which was the Parisian style, as they called it euphemistically, review. So it was that. It's also really the start of doing entertainment in Las Vegas, which is more rationalized economically. You know, before they started doing this in the mid-50s, they had wars over who was going to get the top headliner. And a lot of people have probably heard the story about how when Liberace opened the Riviera in 1955, he got $50,000 a week, which was huge money. I mean, that's huge money now, so imagine what that was then. So this couldn't go on much further, and they couldn't just keep on bidding against each other for these celebrity headliners. So instead they said, well, we'll bring the girls over from Paris. If one of them decides she doesn't like it or wants more money, we can always bring over more girls from Paris. So it's really the start of them doing entertainment that's unique to Vegas, but it makes a little bit more sense for them economically. And that has continued into the Cirque shows and those kinds of shows, where people don't go to see the headliner necessarily, they're seeing the show itself. So the show itself is the star.
I was saddened to hear that the show was going at Bally's, just because it really was the last of the old Vegas shows. You know, it used to be a Vegas show meant, you know, boobs and feathers and uh-huh. just enormous production, you know, numbers. And that was the last of them. I mean, and they literally would sink the Titanic on stage. If for people who haven't seen it, it was truly an amazing thing to see, even with all the kitsch and, you know, and all of that. But, you know, so it's the end of an era. You know, those shows are now gone.
It is, but, you know, they renamed that tower the Jubilee Tower, so they're going to bring it back. I don't know what it's going to look like when they bring it back. You know, probably, I don't think sure it has been updated much since it debuted about 30 years ago. So I think they just wanted to give it that little, you know, whatever. The question is, what can you do? Because,
well, the articles I read sounded like they were really going to modernize it. I mean, you know, the Titanic is gone and rap numbers are in, you know, so.
But the thing is, I don't see how you can modernize that, because you can't. You know, you're not going to outdo Miley Cyrus or something like that. You know, you can't. So the shock factor isn't going to be there. Is it going to be more sophisticated and more sedate and more artistic? You know, I guess you could go in that direction. But it's kind of this kind of show is a weird place in the culture today because, again, you can see stuff that's so much more salacious and shocking and all that. You know, I don't really know where you go with it outside of keeping it kind of as a time capsule of this more innocent time where this was considered shocking. So I'm very curious to see where they go with it.
I want to go back to lotteries for a second. I had always heard, you know, this meme that the American Revolution was funded by lotteries. I didn't see any mention of it in your book. Is that fact or fiction?
It's somewhat fact. And the first edition of the book focused on lotteries, bingo, horse racing, and casinos. This one, responding to what a lot of the readers wanted, is just casinos. So it's about the same length, but I just added a lot more casino information, so that's why it's not in this edition. But if you read the first edition, you'll find it in there. They paid for some stuff. You know, I've heard some people claim that it paid for everything. You've got to understand that back then, lotteries were not run by the government for the most part. They were mostly run by private promoters. Somebody would say, you know, a church would say, we want to build a new building, and we're going to have a lottery, and they would apply to the legislature, and the legislature would give them a charter to run that lottery. So you had this, but it would be run by a private person. Sometimes the promoters were honest. A lot of the times they weren't. They would collect all the money and then just skip town before holding the lottery. They wouldn't pay people off. So there was a lot of scandals, you know. But before, there were a lot of things that were paid for. You know, there were some things at places like Harvard and Columbia, certainly not the entire college, because if it was, it wouldn't be called Harvard. It would be named for the lottery, because that's where the money would come from. So there's some stuff, I think, you know, some things like roads. Basically, what lotteries were they were a way to sell property in a lot of cases, not just money, when you didn't have things like mortgages. So if you're building a house, and nobody can afford to pay you in cash for the house, what you can do if you're the builder is you can hold a lottery. And everybody buys tickets for $10, and whoever wins the lottery gets the house, and you get the price of the house. So that's where a lot of the lotteries were. So it's very different from what it's become today.
So what was the first we are about gambling with an edge. So what was the first instance you came across of advantage play, not people cheating, but people actually getting an advantage over the house?
Well, it's interesting because, again, this kind of shows how that line is sometimes thinner than we think. So, for example, a lot of people try to make money with gambling systems in Monte Carlo and lost money. A lot of people try to make money by cheating, and some of them won in the short term. One guy was the first guy to figure out wheel bias and was able to watch the wheels and figured out that this one wheel had a bias, and he was able to exploit that. You know, now, you know, I'll ask you, is that cheating?
No, of course not.
You know, So he's just using his eyes. He didn't alter the wheel. He's just watching the wheel. He notices that this wheel is out of alignment and is able to predict where the ball is more likely to play, and he made a ton of money. And don't know the exact year offhand. It was I think it was sometime around 1880, somewhere in that range. So that was really the earliest, you know, example of that You know, when you get into a game like poker, obviously that involves skill from the beginning, so you had skillful players. But this was really the first place that I found where people used skill to win casino games. Now, if you go back, and I'll tell you what happened. After they figured it out, they first tried moving that wheel around, and he would go after the wheel and find it. Then eventually what they did was they would calibrate the wheels at the beginning of every day and spin them and make sure they were correctly balanced. So the earlier thing that you see, which isn't as well documented, Casanova, of course, who's notorious for lots of things besides just gambling, in his diary claimed that he was able to consistently make money at Faro by using a betting system. And again, you know, is this really true? I don't know. It's not, you know, I wouldn't classify that as skill because it's just a money management system. And I don't think he was able to actually get a positive expectation of a game. I think he just got lucky and probably quit when he was ahead more than letting himself get sucked in. But I think that what happened with the wheel bias in Monte Carlo was the first modern example of that.
Well, there's always been acting with more information on contests between people, whether it was or horse racing or
boxing,
those type of things, where people would use inside information to gain an edge. And so I don't know that this is particularly casino gambling, but it is definitely gambling. And
yeah.
And it's definitely an edge. And that's been going on for, well, probably back to Damian Pythias. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. And, you do see that pretty much everywhere. And that's really where handicapping came from. Some people were able to judge these things better than other people, and they made money taking bets and becoming handicappers.
You know, there was something in the book about a Greek syndicate like 100 years ago who was supposedly making money counting cards at Baccarat, which I'm skeptical of. But can you talk about what they were doing?
That was part of it. And the interesting thing about this is that the Baccarat, as it was played in France at the time, is not the Baccarat that's played in Nevada. So it was chemin de fer, where the bank passes from player to player. So this group of guys got together, called the Greek Syndicate, and under the leadership of a guy named Nick the Greek Zografos, not Nick the Greek Dandelos, who was in America later on. So this was in France in the early 20th century. They pooled their money together and said, what we're going to do is we're going to take on anybody who wants to play Baccarat. Pretty much, we're going to hold the bank at the casino. The casino just took a 5% cut of every pot. All right, they didn't care who won. So it was a lot more like a California card room than a Baccarat room.
Oh, okay, and in chemin de fer, they had some options about whether they were drawing cards or not, right, on certain hands?
So the way he could make money is that supposedly Nick the Greek had this photographic memory, would remember every single card ever dealt. And again, I am skeptical of being able to count cards, so to speak, in Baccarat, but it was a combination for them of money management, being able to outlast other people, and having a bigger bankroll. I think they had a bankroll of 50 million francs. So that will get you very far in a game where you're playing the banker side and you've got that small built-in edge against them. Even if you're paying that 5% commission to the house, that'll get you there. Also, because they weren't the house, because they were just players banking it, when the odds were against them, they could just give up and go. So that is what helped them. So when they were doing well, they could really grind it out because they had this big bankroll. When Nick the Greek thought things were going against them, he would just say, I'm not taking any more bets. So that's what made them successful. And again, we don't have the kind of documentation you would have today, but by all accounts, they did very well.
Yeah, well, if they had discretion about whether to draw a card on totals of, you know, four or five, things like that, which they may have had in chemin de fer, then I could see where an edge could be had from counting.
Yeah, they did. And because in chemin de fer they're banking it, they're taking the cards, you're not bound by the house. They were not bound by the house rules. So it was a lot more, the game of Baccarat then was a lot more freewheeling than it is today, where pretty much it's not really too much for the player to do except for pick one side. It's a lot more freewheeling. And there was a lot, you know, if you remember the original Casino Royale and, you know, are you going to draw a card, Mr. Bond, and that sort of thing. There's a lot more of that element to it.
Uh-huh.
Very good. Professor Schwartz, thank you. This is your second visit. We asked you last time if you were considering writing a history of Vegas itself. You've written lots of things in the general subject, but just a history of Vegas. Are you thinking of that, or are you in the middle of that, or how's that?
Well, I'm interested in that. I'm kind of looking at a couple ideas for my next book, and that's definitely one of them. There's a lot of really interesting stories. I think that it's good to write the big history books like Roll the Bones, but it's also nice to write a book that's a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And people seem to really like that a lot, and that resonates with them. So I may write a couple of smaller books that are just a self-contained story, but definitely I'll be working on the big history of Vegas casinos for quite some time. And I think that I'll be very glad when I'm able to get that one done, because it's going to be a lot of research.
I'm sure. Professor David Schwartz, thank you very much. It's very informative. We appreciate you taking the time to visit with us.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Richard, what did you learn from the book, or what do you think our readers would learn from the book if they got it?
Well, one of the interesting things was this: these first advantage players, the bias roulette wheels. You know, it's funny because it's exactly the same thing today. When somebody starts beating a wheel, they start switching them around in the casino and moving them around, and you know the skilled players can tell that it's been moved. I also thought it was interesting that you had to wear a mask. I just love that. Reminds me of that movie Eyes Wide Shut with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. What about you?
I knew most of these historical stories because I'm an avid reader, and there's several gambling things that I've read over the years that can't give you titles, and it's nice to get a reminder. I keep picturing that when he talks the sections about the American, the Wild Wild West, how gamblers here presented a little bit differently than they were on Gunsmoke or Rawhide or those kind of places. That was just a I suspect those saloons in those cattle towns were pretty wild places.
Yeah, and the riverboats on the Mississippi. Yeah.
Yes, I actually have a sign that I picked up in New Orleans saying something like, they used to post it on the riverboats that said, "Gamblers and loose women must register with a captain before leaving New Orleans." I always found that an interesting sign to have. Bonnie is not quite as enamored with it as I am. All right.
Well, listen, after the commercials, if we have time, I have to tell you my favorite opening the slot machine story. So,
good. We'll make time for that. South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else. In February, they have giveaways. The fourth gift, for which you can begin earning points this Saturday, is an 8-piece steak night set. You need to earn 500 points Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, and then you pick up the knives next Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. Next week's free video poker class is Double Double Bonus Quick Quads. This is the game I play during Double Point Days, and it's the highest returning game in the house in terms of dollars per hour. In addition, arguably it's the most fun. There are a few other games in the casino where the edge is higher percentage-wise, but they're only available for lower stakes. It's a heaven or hell game. I play at the $60 per hand, $1.10 play version. I've had six-hour sessions where I've been down $15,000. I've had several 6 or 8 hour sessions where I've been up considerably more than that. You can play for lower stakes, but any version of double-double bonus makes for high volatility. It's not a game for the timid. At the Palms, they have completely reformatted their weekly drawings. They're Friday night only, 7 o'clock. You can earn an unlimited amount of tickets. 10 winners each Friday night for a total of $10,000 will be posted. You don't have to be there, but you have to claim it before midnight. If you do not claim it before midnight, the prizes evaporate. So, five-time tickets on Fridays and Saturdays from 8 to midnight, 2 times tickets Sundays and Tuesdays. You're also a guaranteed winner. Sign up for the drawing before 7 o'clock on Friday. And if you don't win, you get $10 guaranteed free play on Saturday. play, earn, and win. The biggest prizes are $200 Albertsons gift card and a $100 Palms gift card. Smaller gifts are available, and as always, you get to keep the points. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a very wide variety of games. Often these games are the best returning games in the casino. They no longer have daily contests, but rather weekly contests and even a monthly contest. The weekly contest, you have a choice of three games. This week is 100 Play with Quick Quads, Wheel Poker, and Deal Draw. We haven't spoken recently about Deal Draw Poker, so here's a brief description. It's a version of the old classic called Double Pay Poker, where you get paid on the deal and then hold cards on the bottom hand like you would in any triple play, five-play, or ten-play game, and then you get paid on the draw. It's a 10-coin-per-line game. In the older Double Pay version, it was possible to get confused between whether you're in the deal mode or the draw mode, and you could accidentally throw away all your cards without holding any. Now, in this version, if you hold zero cards while in the draw mode, a box will pop up letting you reconsider it if you want. You can certainly hold zero cards, but this largely prevents you from accidentally throwing away a hand where you should be holding something. The strategy for the game is exactly the same as a regular video poker game. The return on the deal section, which is strictly luck, is always a little higher than the return on the base game. So if you can find the same pay schedule on a deal draw machine that you would play video poker on, then it's wise to switch to the deal draw. The monthly contest is different than it was before. Now you can play up to 5 100 game rounds a day, and the winner is determined by the total cumulative score for the month. Since today is the 20th, it's not feasible to enter this particular contest this month. But it sounds like your cup of tea. Plan on beginning March 1st and see how it goes. Richard, why don't you tell us who's going to be our guest next week, and then tell us about the slot machine opening you wanted to tell us about.
Okay. Our guest next week is Chris McKinley, who there was an article in Wired magazine a while back where he basically hacked OkCupid. He was a member of a very large blackjack team. We're going to talk about this is one of my favorite things, is how advantage play can creep over into your normal life and how to take advantage of other situations besides gambling games. So it was a really interesting article, and he's now put out a book called Optimal Cupid about it. And so especially if you're looking to date, that might be something to read. Right. Okay, so the slot machine story.
Make it a one-minute story.
Okay, there's a guy I've been trying to interview for 10 years that has been dodging me all this time. But anyway, back in the 60s, he was part of a team where they would do exactly that, open the slot machines, and he was a very small guy, so he would be the one who would go inside, set all the wheels, reels, they would close the door, pull the handle, boom, hit the slot, hit the thing. So he was. They were doing one of those really giant machines, like at the Four Queens. They had it open. He was setting the reels, and a security guard started coming their way, and his teammates just pushed him inside and locked the machine back up. Left him in there for about 4 or 5 hours before they found it was safe enough to come back and open the machine and let him back out.
Did he ever forgive them?
Yeah, I guess he did.
Wow. It's... if somebody played it, I guess the machine was still playable while he was in there?
Yeah, he was down underneath the reels in the bottom.
So if that was when coins would fall into the thing, so he'd have to get out of the way. Thank you very much, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.